This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that the campaign is over, my guest can tell what he knows. Journalist Mark Miller spent the past year with the Clinton campaign. Bill Clinton granted Miller special access under the condition that he wait until after the election before writing about the campaign. Miller is a correspondent for Newsweek's special post-election issue, which has just been published. This issue also has behind-the-scenes reports on the Bush and Perot campaigns. Later we'll hear from the reporters who wrote those stories. Bill Clinton just won a solid victory, but 5 months ago, when he was about to come out the winner in the primaries, his campaign was in serious trouble.
It was a very interesting and frustrating time for him, because even as he was winning primary after primary and state after state, and he was clear he was going to be the nominee by, you know, June 2nd, for example, when he locked it up by winning California, Ohio, and New Jersey, he had won, but it didn't really matter. He was third in the polls. Perot had stolen all of his thunder. He was furious that Perot was getting the attention that he was. Perot essentially stole the mantle of outsider from him instantly, and consigned Clinton and Bush to the same category as being part of the problem, not part of the solution. And everyone had written Clinton off. The press was sort of bored with him, and you know, the joke was that, you know, he was going to come in third, and that the Democrats would, you know, be forever banished to after-run status. And so the campaign knew that something had to be done, obviously, since they were in such deep trouble. And they knew that he had a problem, but they weren't quite sure what it was. Most of the reporters covering the campaign thought that it was related specifically to the allegations of Jennifer Flowers or the draft, that these were these two twin character issues that were the problem for Clinton. And so his staff, after the New York primary, actually, while they were sitting in a hotel room pondering the future of the campaign or the lack of one, decided that they had to begin a research effort, which one semi-jokingly named the Manhattan Project in honor of where they were, and also the nuclear nature of what they were dealing with in terms of Clinton's candidacy. And it was a $100,000 effort, largely paid for by the Democratic National Committee, which involved focus groups, polls, memos written by outside consultants, dial groups in which people measured their reactions to things that they were watching on a television screen. And what they found was quite interesting. People were bothered by Clinton because they thought he was the typical politician. He was someone who would never tell them the truth. There's a fascinating focus group in Allentown, Pennsylvania, in which a woman who was struggling to express her feelings actually came up with one of the most, you know, cogent analysis of the campaign when she said that it's like if you ask Bill Clinton his favorite color, he would say plaid. And from then on, whenever Clinton would waffle on something, his staff would say, oh, you know, it's a plaid problem again. But that was the perception. His answers on Jennifer Flowers and the draft fed that perception, but they were not the problem per se. And they, you know, the campaign was somewhat relieved because they weren't convinced that you could fix the image of a perceived adulterer. But you could, they thought, fix the image of someone who seemed to be too political.
Is that why they decided to have him tell more of his personal story?
That's exactly why. Stan Greenberg, the pollster, found that when he presented the focus groups with details of his life, of Clinton's life, for instance, that he had grown up in a poorer home, that he had stood up to his alcoholic abusive stepfather, that he had worked his way through college, that he had taken on special interests in Arkansas, people's attitudes and perceptions of Clinton changed remarkably. I mean, you could see it in the progression of the focus groups, and it was actually quite dramatic. And they would begin to say things like, well, I've never read this before. I never knew this before. Sounds like he has more morals or ethics than the media gives him credit for. And by the end of the focus groups, this was the one I just cited, was one of 10 women. They were now voting for Clinton overwhelmingly. And the same thing happened among the men.
After the Jennifer Flowers story was damaging Clinton's standing, the campaign made the decision that he should go on 60 Minutes with Hillary Clinton and talk about their marriage. Who was behind that decision to go on 60 Minutes, and why was Clinton so angry at the way the segment turned out? You wrote that he was really, really upset when he watched it.
Yeah, he was furious. 60 Minutes was contacted by a member of Clinton's entourage. It wasn't a staff person per se, but it was one of his advisors. And they were very interested, obviously, at the prospect of having Bill Clinton come on their show. And it was to be for the show leading into Super Bowl, the Super Bowl game. So it was guaranteed to have an enormous audience anyway. And it was a risky move because Clinton was not particularly well known at that point. The things people knew about him were that he, you know, was being accused of having cheated on his wife. And so the idea that of going on national TV, talking to, you know, tens of millions of Americans for the first time and introducing himself as someone who was defending himself against charges of marital infidelity was a scary prospect to Clinton. And he worried about that. And he wasn't sure that if by going on 60 Minutes, it wouldn't give the press the right or at least give them the excuse to go into all the rumors and other stories and all the allegations that had been made against him. Because up until that point, you know, the press coverage of Jennifer Flowers had been uneven. I mean, some papers had covered it, some papers hadn't. A lot of local TV had covered it, but some of the nets really hadn't covered it. So it was sort of uneven, and they weren't quite sure how it was going to shake down in the end. But they decided that, and this was something that James Carville, who by this point was emerging as his chief strategist, argued that it was better to deal with it in January than it would be to deal with it in the fall, and that they had to get it behind them, and that, you know, this was the kind of preemptive blow, or at least a tough way to stand up to the story, and that they should go on the nation's most famous, you know, the program perceived to be the toughest interview, and talk about the issues. And he was angry about it because in the negotiations with 60 Minutes, the program's producers had promised that it would run substantially longer than it had, than it did ultimately run. They also promised that other campaign issues would be discussed, and that the program would not be limited solely to Jennifer Flowers. And throughout the taping, as they answered questions, and it was quite an emotional taping, and many of their answers were quite powerful, the producers there told him that it was fabulous TV. They, you know, were just ecstatic by how wonderful it was. And Don Hewitt told him that, you know,
this is the producer.
Yeah, Don Hewitt, the producer, told him that he, you know, had thought that they'd had a hand in making one president before. I think he was referring to the debates, the Kennedy-Nixon debates, and that he thought that would happen again this time, and that the ending had been very powerful. The ending that they agreed was very powerful and didn't, in fact, run, and it was much shorter than they expected, and it dealt exclusively with Jennifer Flowers. And I think Clinton felt, part of it was just the tension and the frustration that he was feeling at that point, but he was angry with the way that the show had been handled.
My guest is Mark Miller, a correspondent for Newsweek, and he spent a year with the Clinton campaign, and he has a story about the Clinton campaign in the new election issue of Newsweek. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the Clinton campaign with Mark Miller, who's a special correspondent for Newsweek, and he spent a year with the Clinton campaign. Getting back to the Jennifer Flowers story, being inside the campaign during the Jennifer Flowers ruckus, did you get the impression that there ever was an affair between the two of them?
I got the impression that there had not been any sustained affair, and that there had not been anything that would actually qualify as an affair between the two of them. I think they knew each other. I'm not entirely sure what might have transpired between the two of them, but I don't believe that there was... let me put it this way. He was asked by one of his chief strategists whether or not he had had an affair with her, and Clinton's response was no, that he had not had a sexual affair with her. And that was done in privacy. And there was never any meeting in which, there was a discussion of, well, okay, I know people think I've had an affair. I did this with her, but we've got to say this. There was never anything like that. What you saw basically publicly was what he was saying privately.
The issue of the draft dogged Clinton throughout the campaign. In April, he said he was going to release all of his draft-related files, which he never did. Why didn't he?
I don't know. No one in his campaign is quite sure either. There were two people who who knew the full story of Bill Clinton's draft record, and that was the candidate and a longtime aide named Betsy Wright. And their relationship was very strange and enigmatic to those on the staff who had not worked for Clinton before this presidential campaign, and actually even strange to those who had known Clinton for some time. She was the so-called Department of Defense. It was her job to defend the Arkansas record and to defend him against personal attacks. And she found the draft induction notice that he had admitted that he had received, but it was never released. And no one in the senior staff ever saw it. No one ever really knew what was the full story. She refused to share information, even with his closest confidants on the campaign and his senior staff. And it was just something that no one was quite sure what the truth was.
Are you suggesting that she kept this to have something on him in a way?
No, not deliberately. I don't think so, mm-hmm. No. I mean, she was completely devoted to Bill Clinton.
How worried were the managers of the Clinton campaign about the draft question?
Extraordinarily worried. That was their biggest fear. After the Republican convention, I asked one of the senior staffers, one of the senior consultants, about what he was most afraid of, and he said the draft, and they all agreed on that. I mean, it just hung over the campaign, you know, like a black cloud. They always felt its presence.
What were they most worried about?
They were worried about some of the stories that actually eventually came out. They were worried about whether or not they knew the full story. They were worried about how to answer reporters' questions because they weren't sure themselves of what the absolute truth was, and they didn't want to be caught having to reverse themselves on something that they had said. I mean, they were just very unsure of what the issue was. They even filmed a commercial at one point in which Clinton spoke directly to camera talking about the draft issue and how he, you know, recognized that he had not answered some of the questions as well as he should have, and that he recognized that some people might want to vote against him, but that he hoped that they would, you know, look to the future. He used that ad never ran, mostly because the focus groups showed that people were not that I shouldn't say that they weren't bothered by it. They were bothered by it, but they weren't going to vote on it. It was interesting. For a while, when you would present the focus groups with information on the draft, the people around the table would look down. You know, they would look at their shoes. They would sort of shuffle around, and you know, they were clearly bothered by it. They didn't want to vote on it, but they were bothered by it. Once Bush made it an issue, once George Bush began raising it, it suddenly, in their mind, became another political attack, and they didn't care. They thought that Clinton had lied about the draft. They thought that he had probably dodged the draft. And they didn't care, or they didn't want to hear anything more about it. They might care, they just were not interested, in another word, about the draft.
Hillary was kind of put in the closet by the campaign for a while because she had gotten the image of being too much the feminist and too much the professional woman.
That is sort of true, but not completely. What they did lower her profile, but what she did was quite interesting. She began, I mean, she still toured the country. She still made many, many trips. But she was going principally to what they considered to be secondary markets, much smaller markets than the candidate could afford to go to and spend time on. And she did interviews with all the local press. She talked nonstop to local reporters. She just didn't do interviews with the national press. So our perception was she's dropped off the radar screen. They've muzzled her. But in fact, she was actually going around still doing her thing, just maintaining a slightly lower profile at doing it.
Now, you say that early on in the campaign, she saw the campaign as a rehearsal for 1996. She never expected that Clinton would actually win in 92. So she wasn't as diplomatic in some of the things that she was saying.
I think, and she said this to me again a few weeks ago, that she did not fully appreciate how much her words would be analyzed and how careful she had to be and how, in fact, people didn't know her and didn't know Bill Clinton, and that they didn't have a context for the things that she was saying, so that when they saw sound bites or snippets of conversations, they got a completely different, or at least a distorted view of her than what she perceived herself to be, and she had to be careful about that.
Were there a lot of fights between Clinton and the campaign about how to handle certain issues or about, you know, how he should present himself?
I wouldn't say that there were a lot of fights. There were concerns on the part of the staff, for example, that his answers to hot-button issues like abortion tended to be too processy, tended to be too technical. I mean, it took him a long time to get to the point. You could, in one of the dial groups, for example, they showed an answer to a question about abortion in one of the televised town meetings that he did. And he sort of rambled along until he finally got, you know, 5 minutes into it, in which he said he supported the right to choose. And the line went up, signifying that people approved of what he was saying. But until then, it had been static, and he was losing people because it took him so long to get to the point of what he was saying. So there was a constant battle to try to make him more, you know, more punchy, more sort of, not exactly to produce more sound bites, but to get more to the point. And his view was, look, you know, these are complicated issues. These are not black and white issues. I don't have black and white feelings about them. People don't have black and white feelings about them. And, you know, I can't just whittle down everything into a 30-second stump speech.
Can you take us inside the room of the war room, so to speak, and tell us what the atmosphere was like in there when they were responding to a Bush attack?
Much like a command center in a you know, like a nuclear destroyer or something like that. I mean, it was obviously a lot less high tech than that, befitting James Carville's image. He would sit in the center of the room. There was an enormous table, a conference table that he sat behind. Mostly he lay on this couch. I mean, the couch was a fixture in all the campaigns that he's run, and he always has to have a couch, and he sort of lays there with his eyes half shut, sort of dreaming up new things to say and ways to respond to things. And he's surrounded by a bunch of young sort of minions who do his bidding, who were there to look up, you know, the latest economic statistics that Bush was attacking Clinton on in Arkansas that were misleading, or to hammer Bush on broken promises. There were people who dealt with polling, people who dealt with, you know, opposition research, and people who, you know, dealt with getting the information to the press department. And it seemed somewhat disorganized, but it all seemed to function. They all had a job to do, and they all knew what they were doing, and they were all incredibly motivated. I mean, it was something to see, because they felt so painfully the experience of 1988 that they were just determined not to let that happen again.
What was the most frightening moment for the campaign inside the campaign, you know, from their perspective? The moment when things looked like they were about to disrupt?
Oh, there were so many. I mean, I had never really covered a campaign full time before, but anyone who had been connected with it had said that they had never gone through anything like this. I mean, it was such a manic depressive campaign. I mean, that was one way they referred to it. Carville said, you know, they ought to just put Prozac dispensers at the water fountains. In part because they were always, you know, so off. It was not a very even keeled place to be in some cases, and some of the people around it were very strange and weird. But I think one of the worst moments, there were a couple of horrible moments for them, and one was the day before Junior Tuesday, the primaries in Georgia and Maryland and Colorado. The day before, they thought it was over. People actually left the headquarters and went to long lunches and talked about what they were going to be doing. They were just convinced that they would not get a sizable enough win in Georgia, and that Tsongas was actually going to win at that point. And of course, the next day, he got a huge majority in Georgia, and Georgia saved him, and he went on and killed off Tsongas as a candidate. And then the other one was the day of the June 2nd primaries, the last rounds of primaries, the day he had locked it up. He gave a speech that night claiming victory, but it was the most sort of... He seemed quite down and quite rattled, and the campaign was down. It was the most anticlimactic victory I'd ever seen. And I think they just, at that point, were not quite sure what they could do and whether or not they could win.
James Carville of the Clinton campaign and Mary Madeline of the Bush campaign have been romantically involved. What do you think it was like for Carville to try to continue that relationship while they were in opposite camps?
It was difficult for both of them, particularly at the debates when they would be in the what was called spin alley, and they would be spinning reporters on their perceptions of how the debates had won. And, you know, they would be standing a few feet away from each other, and I think it was quite difficult for them both. It was more difficult for her in some ways because she was losing. And, you know, it's always more difficult when you're losing.
How much were they seeing each other during the campaign?
Oh, after June, Carville spent almost all of his time in Little Rock, and I think he saw her a few times in Washington. He didn't generally take much time off, mm-hmm. and she didn't have a lot of time on her own either. They talked a lot on the phone, but they did not have vast amounts of time to see each other.
One last question. Did observing the campaign from such a close vantage point make you any more or less cynical about American politics?
I have mixed feelings about it. I became much more cynical and much more sort of disgusted with Washington in general. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times we watched the talk shows, the pundit shows in Washington pronounced Clinton dead, and, you know, there's just no way he could win. And, you know, they were always wrong. And there were, you know, one of the lead reporters for the New York Times, whom I probably shouldn't name, would write stories that were just completely wrong and so out of touch with what was really happening with people. And I became much more cynical about our connection, the press's connection, with what real people are actually thinking. And that is something that I would want to guard against should I be covering a campaign in the future or an administration. I mean, they become just as sort of isolated as the president can be in his White House.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mark Miller is a correspondent for Newsweek. His report on the Clinton campaign is published in a special election edition of the magazine. On the second part of our show, reports on the Bush and Perot campaigns. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.